Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Today, I'm joined once again by Jared Banks, a residential architect, BIM expert, and founder of Shunom Architects in Seattle. Jared began his career focused on technology and consulting before transitioning into residential design, where he now creates thoughtful homes while continuing to share his deep knowledge of BIM with the profession. He's also a leader in the small firm community and a co-founder of an architect-led development company, which is what we're going to talk about today. Jared brings a unique perspective on combining design, technology, and entrepreneurship to build a more resilient and rewarding practice. He's been here before. You probably recognize his name. If you've searched anything on ArchiCAD, you've found Jared or Shunom. Episode 493, we talked about his consulting work and with ArchiCAD, learning to BIM. Episode 524, we talked about him sharing a new paradigm. We sort of talked about the practice of architecture in general. Two guys who are interested in the profession and the future profession, we talked about that. Conversation was fun. And then we brought him back at 5:50 and he told his whole story and how he went from as an intern all the way through starting his own practice or working with consulting for BIM, for ArchiCAD, then starting his own practice. And at the very end of that episode, he teased a little bit about architect as developer and that he was getting into development. And a couple months ago, he reached out and said, hey, we should do it. Follow up and do a little update on development work. So this one, we're going to talk about architect as developer. Jared Banks, welcome back to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to have another conversation.
Yeah, I always love talking with you. We are very aligned in our worlds and what we're trying to do. And actually, throughout our careers, we've always bumped into each other on and off. And it's always fun to catch up and to say hello. And I love bringing you on the podcast and letting everybody hear our conversations. And so it's good to have you here.
Yeah, it's great to be here. And I think today is going to be a little different than the previous episodes.
Good. That's good. We're going to skip the origin story. If you want to hear Jared's full story, go back to episode 550. That was the entire episode was his origin story all the way to what he's doing today. Today, we're going to talk about development. And where we left off in that episode 550 was he was just getting started, right, Jared? So it was scary and you were just figuring it out. And it's been a while, a year and a half, 2 years or whatever it's been. And so why don't you give us the origin story of your development practice? Maybe where did that idea come from and share that story of where that started and how you got to where you are now?
Sure. So the origin goes back to just talking with friends. So when I moved to Seattle 12 years ago, one of the first people I met was a fellow architect, Carrie Westerbeck.
Yeah.
And we collaborated on some stuff and just became friends. And we'd always talk about stuff. And maybe about 10 years ago, he bought a property and developed a small building on that property. And so when he was developing it, we talked a lot about it. And, you know, we're always talking about our businesses and all this stuff. And then that building finished and he talked about how he wants to transition to do architect as developer full time. And I thought, That's such a cool idea. I love trying new things. I would love to, you know, also do this development thing. And so we just, you know, talked about it here and there, random conversations. And then a couple of times properties came up and we would get serious about it and nothing ever happened. And then in 2022, he was hired by a person who had a small piece of property to do a feasibility study on it. So Carrie did the feasibility study on it and the client decided, you know what? I don't want to deal with this. I'm just going to sell the property. And Carrie and I had been talking about doing development and he'd already done the feasibility on this property and it seemed viable. At the same time, he'd also been talking with another friend of his, Brent, who is a contractor. And the three of us decided to put an offer in on this property. So the moment it went on the market, we already knew everything about it. We put in an offer. I think maybe someone else also put an offer on the property, but the homeowner or the property owner knew us and trusted Carrie. And so we got the property. That's kind of a long-winded way of just saying, just talking with a friend about, wouldn't it be cool to do this? And then one day that wouldn't it be cool to do this turned into actually doing it.
Can you describe the property? What does it look like? How big is it?
It's in downtown Bothell. The address is 10120 Northeast 185th Street for anyone who wants to go look it up. I think on Google Maps right now, it shows either a construction site or the old house that was on the property. But it's a little 5,000 square foot rectangle, basically flat at the edge of downtown Bothell. So Bothell, Washington, for people who don't know, is a small town just northeast of the tip of Lake Washington. So it's a suburb of Seattle, about 20, 25 minutes out of town.
Then did you mention how big it is? How big is it?
Yeah. So about 5,000 square feet.
5,000 square feet.
I think 50, I used to know all these numbers by heart. It's like 5,200. Skipping around, one of the things we dealt with is a pretty small property and the city of Bothell took some of it from us to widen the alley and to widen the street. So we had a small property and then we lost about 5.5 feet of that, 2 or 3 feet in the front and maybe 2.5 feet in the back, which, you know, is frustrating, but
yeah,
just one of the many things that we discovered in this process of like, oh.
So was that after you purchased it?
It was. So we'd purchased it. We had done an initial design of the property and we went to the pre-application. So the city had like a first meeting where you sit down with a bunch of people from the planning department, you show them the plans and say, this is what we intend to do. And then they drop a lot of surprises on you.
Yeah.
Some of those surprises were things that had we read the zoning code better or looked at some of the code stuff, we would have caught that. Other things were, we just had no idea that the city wants to widen the alley whenever there's development. And so they just get the alley from you. So
the development, the idea of developing the property was what triggered them to widen the alley.
Yeah. So there was basically a provision in the code that they want all alleys to be 20 feet wide. But our alley, which is an historic old alley, is 16 feet wide. So whenever there's development on the property or when there's development along the alley, they will then take land to widen it so that over the next 100 years, the alley can be, you know, 20 feet wide everywhere.
So did that just become an easement or did they actually do the work?
It's such a weird thing. And so much of this is blurry after having spent 3.5+ years on this property. It's not an easement. It's theirs now, but I think we still pay property taxes on it. It's
how convenient.
So it's not an easement, it's something slightly different. And I'd have to look back at the records. And that's the thing with development. You learn so much of this little nuanced stuff and then it's like burned into your brain 6 months later.
Yeah.
It's buried so deep from all the other things that are going on that you can't remember the ins and outs of that.
Yeah, and I can imagine that's probably a strategy for many municipalities that the developers come in. Typically, they're large companies with lots of money. And they say, if you want to develop this, you have to do X, Y, and Z to the roads and to the alley. In this case, not a big, rich company.
Right.
But, you know, the rule is the rule.
It's a really good point that being a small developer, municipalities are not set up to deal with us, right?
Yeah.
Because they're expecting, yeah, deeper pockets, people with, I don't want to say more experience, but maybe lawyers or just like know how to push back or whatever the big guys can do. Us little people who are just kind of scraping by and trying to figure out how it goes or wanting to do something different.
Yeah. So what was the zone? What were you allowed to build on it?
So it was called Downtown Transition. So we could go up to 35 feet, I think. And at the time, zoning codes have now in Bothell improved, so we could actually do a lot more on the property. But the short version of it was 0.75 parking spaces per bedroom and the height limit. There were some other things like the total square footage, lot coverage, all that stuff. But really the driving factors for the project were the relationship between parking spaces to bedrooms and then the height limit. So we ended up doing 4 townhouses with 6 surface parking spaces. 4 of those spaces are tandem. And then each unit is 2 bedrooms plus den, because for permitting purposes, a den doesn't count, which meant we had 8 bedrooms on the property, 4 dens and 6 parking spaces. It's insane that you get in development, you're trying something new, you're removing the client, you get to be the client. There's a whole piece of that we could talk about. You have all these grand ideas for what to do on the property, and then it's a parking diagram.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
We previously, before we settled on 4 townhouses, each townhouse is about 1,700 square feet. We looked at a small apartment building. We looked at all sorts of different configurations to get 8, 12 units on there, but it all came down to parking. And the best we could do was these 6 parking spaces off the back of the alley. And then we got to build a building around that.
Got it. You said it's transitional zoning. So could you do commercial as well if you wanted to, or did it have to be residential?
I think it had to be residential. And there's no way we would have done commercial even if we could have. Doing my first development project with a partner who had gone through this once before was really helpful. One of the things Kerry learned from his building is he did 3 residential units in 1 small commercial space, which is great. It's a little corner barbershop. His building is like 4 blocks from our building. But what he discovered is financing for a mixed-use building is so difficult. Financing for us was a roller coaster, but at least it was all residential, so it was pretty straightforward. So,
yeah, let's talk about money.
Yeah.
How did the initial purchase of the property happen? Because that's always the question, right? Architects, everybody has this big grand idea.
Yeah.
I'd love to be an architect developer, but I have no idea how to pay for that first property. So how did you do it?
So we basically paid cash. So there's 3 of us partners who all have strong long-term marriages. So there's 3 business partners, but there's also 3 spouses involved as well.
There's 6 partners.
Yeah, I'd say I'm the partner who's been married the least, and my wife and I will be celebrating 23 years of marriage in June. So like, this is like long-term set of marriages.
Right.
So I think step 1 to doing development is have a good partner who has a nice stable job, because that helps.
Yeah.
But basically, we split the cost of the building, of the property, amongst the 3 of us, and each of us basically handled that money separately, whether it was getting a HELOC and borrowing against our house, taking money out of retirement, whatever. I don't know, you know, the exact details, and I don't know that's necessarily important, we all basically, the 3 of us took on debt or used assets we had to buy the property, so that our business on day 1, the only debt it had was to ourselves.
Yeah.
Which we loan money to the business. So theoretically, when we sell all the units, which is we'll get to later on in this podcast, we'll pay ourselves back interest. And so we're at least kind of keeping that debt or that interest like within the family.
In thirds?
Yes. Yeah. So we all own equal parts. We decided that while we couldn't put in equal amounts of debt into the property to buy it initially, that's not split 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. We were going to separate out debt from ownership and this is maybe atypical for how small developers do it, but it worked best for the three of us in our friendship, is that we have equal ownership, but then we have different amounts of debt within the business. So we'll pay off debt and then we'll split, you know, profits and all the theoretical gains equally.
Right. So you are equal owners, not equal debt, but it ends up at the end, right? Because whoever put in the most is going to get the most back before you split the rest of it. So once you had the property and you owned it and you had that in your possession, what's the next step?
So the next step for us, and I would do these things slightly different now because, you know, experience and hindsight and all
that's
that.
That's why we're here, right? To share some lessons.
So we bought the property basically September 1st, 2022. And then we were ready for permit June of 2023. And so I'll talk about that period first. The next time I do a project like this, I won't take 9 months to go from buying the property to being ready for permit. I will do that much smaller, or in a much smaller amount of time, just because time is money. And shaving off 3 months then would have been great, especially on the back end for like the timing that we were finishing construction.
What caused the long period of time that you could fix today and the next one?
Not knowing what I was doing.
Yeah, so learning. I mean, so there was a learning curve.
So learning, yeah. And then also there's, I'm going to be skipping all over the place with this conversation. So one of the things I learned in this process is that even though we're equal partners, and I love my two partners, they've been great to work with, one of the things I realized we needed late in the project was really someone to just be the kind of managing principal of the project, right? The person who's just like setting the schedule and not necessarily waiting for consensus, but maybe like pushing that we have to agree on a thing today so that we can do the thing tomorrow, leading the process.
And you didn't do that. You sort of, everybody had their own.
Yeah. We're all kind of laid back and like, well, what do you think? Okay, well, let's meet in a week or let's design this, because
you're friends.
Yeah. We're friends and didn't feel like any urgency. But later on in the process, I've learned that someone being that just like stick is really good. So next time I would be that, and I would just, you know, condense that by a couple of months.
Yeah. So what were your roles? Obviously, Brent was a contractor. Carrie had some development experience. You have the architecture experience. Well, Carrie does as well. So what were your specific roles?
So Brent's was easy. His role, primary role, is contractor. So he built the thing. He swung the hammer. He framed it. He was on site. He basically lived there for, you know, all of construction. The initial intent was for Carrie and I to be basically co-designers, like co-architects. But what happened was early on in the process, he had an opportunity to kind of put his small practice on pause and take a job with the University of Washington. And so he spent, I don't know, a year and a half working for a large institution. And so because of that, his time got constricted, which maybe led to part of the longer time, but for that first phase, but there's lots of reasons. I'm not in any way blaming him for that. But what that meant is I became basically the sole architect on the project. So we definitely collaboratively designed it, but I would do the work and then we would meet and talk about it and he'd give his input, which was lovely. So the way I look at how the project went is I was the architect, Brent was the contractor, and then Carrie was the glue that kind of kept us all together and had a lot of experience and knew the city. And he was always just good to go for anything. So if I was like, hey, Carrie, can you please do X, Y, or Z? He did it. And so he was just filling in kind of everywhere throughout the project. And both having done development and also he oversaw the construction of his previous project, he has a lot of construction experience. So Brent's on site doing construction, Carrie's doing dump runs, or Carrie's, you know, figuring out ordering for flashing and, you know, doing all those things that are kind of contractor stuff, kind of architect stuff, kind of developer stuff. He's just doing a little of everything.
If you could start again and you have three partners in the same roles and, you know, you could be friends or not friends, what would those roles be? Because I would imagine that co-architect is a difficult situation. And would you do that again? Those are a bunch of questions, but...
Well, so I don't think co-architect is that difficult. I mean, Carrie and I have been working on and off on projects for so long. We have a really good working relationship.
So it depends on relationship and personalities for sure.
Yeah. 100%. Like jumping around to lessons learned, personality is everything. Having good relationships is critical. And then just kind of being open and honest, which I think, again, is something that the three of us have done really well of just sharing and being open about like how things are going. So I've definitely tried my hardest to like check in with both my partners and being like, okay, this is rough. How are we feeling? You know, what's everything okay? You know, just because there were some dark times throughout this whole process. So,
yeah. So you wouldn't change the roles, you would do it again the same way.
I think so. I mean, really the biggest change I would do with the three of us, and whether it's myself or Carrie taking on that role, is just having that point person who's kind of driving the project and leading the business, right? So one of the things, we understood that we needed a developer person, we needed a contractor person, we needed an architect person, but the piece we didn't acknowledge early on enough in the process is like we needed a business leader, someone who's looking at it from a dollars and cents standpoint, who's gonna talk to the accountant, who's going to talk to the bookkeeper, who's going to, when a lawyer gets involved for reasons, who's going to like interface with them or whatever.
Yeah.
Or even who's just assigning roles to say, okay, anytime the city has a problem, let's make sure they talk to, you know, person A or person B. So making sure that person is identified from the beginning. And I think what the three of us learned from this process is I'm that person. Really like doing just the business end of the business. So I would do that from day one. And I think that would speed things up. And I think it would also make all of our lives a little easier because it would hopefully free my partners from having to focus or worry on certain things.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great, great lesson learned and shared. So we bought the property.
So we bought the property and the property had a small house on it, but it was fire damaged. So we had a piece of property that couldn't make money. If we did this again, if we had the opportunity to buy a property that was generating rent, that would be nice to make a little money in this first place, but we basically had a vacant property.
Right.
June of 2023, I'm ready to submit for permit, and we had been talking to a lender about getting like a bridge loan. We needed a couple $100,000 to pay for permitting and get construction going. Permitting costs were going to be in like the $100,000 to $200,000 range just from all the expenses of impact fees and whatever. And we were literally in the process of signing loan documents with a lender. And my wife, who is the greatest, is not just signing everything. I should say, every loan we got in this whole project, you know, it's personally guaranteed. So it's under the business name, but it's personally guaranteed by us.
So if you default on it, they're taking your house.
Right, right. So it's like it's a business loan, but it really just feels like a personal loan.
Which is how small businesses work.
Absolutely, absolutely. And going back to the early part of this conversation, spouses. So it's not just the three of us signing, it's the three of us and all our spouses are also signing it. So my wife is reading through the documents and seeing that it really feels like this loan is to her and all our names are on it because my wife has a nice corporate job.
Oh, so she had the most collateral. So
she's the biggest fish.
If this defaults, right? she's gonna take care of it.
So she's getting nervous reading this. And then there's like prepayment penalties. And basically we were misled by the lender that we were working with. So we were on the cusp of having enough money to submit for permit, and then we had to about face and correct and get out of what would have ended up being a very bad loan situation, which if we were more savvy, if we were more educated, whatever, I'm sure there's lots of ways we could have avoided it, but it's a learning process, and part of being an architect developer is just like barreling ahead, because if you pause to think about what a bad idea this is, you never would have done it, right? So you kind of have to go in with little rose-tinted glasses and take some risks.
Yeah. and have a really smart wife who reads contracts before.
Oh my God,
sign.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a very, very smart wife. So we aborted that and ran away from that loan. It took a little while to unpack that, but then we spent the next 6 months, so the back half of 2023, with no money and figuring out what to do. We eventually found a lender. Actually, I should go back. There was a fourth partner when we started this project. I totally forgot about this. We had a fourth partner and his job was going to be-
The mystery partner.
Yeah, the mystery partner. His role was going to be to find money. And once the deal got moving forward, he did some back of the envelope numbers. We were going to try and do rental property rather than townhouses for sale. And he's like, I don't want to wait this long. I think it's a good thing. You guys should do it, but I'm out. So
originally there was a financial partner.
Someone who was going to be financing.
Fourth partner who's going to help with the financing, which is smart, right? That's actually a good idea.
Yes.
To partner with somebody that either has money or can acquire money.
Right. It turns out we didn't need him because 6 months after this first loan fell apart, Carrie had a connection and we were just going to try and fundraise a little bit of money. And so Carrie's talking to this contractor that he knows and he's like, so how much money do you need? And we're like, oh, you know, probably about $2 million. And the guy said, okay, I'll do it. I'll fund you. So we found this wonderful person who had a long-term relationship with Carrie from previous work.
So you did a private loan.
And we did a private loan. It was through a bank. So it's like all like properly secured and above board. And it wasn't just like, you know, on a post-it note, you know, Bob gives Carrie and Jared and Brent money.
So how does that work? He just guarantees the loan?
Yeah. It basically was like a line of credit that we were able to draw on and we, you know, sent monthly draws to his secretary. And I think, I don't know if the money was like held by the bank that we went through or I wasn't too involved with that piece of the puzzle. Good example of why, like, I've been very involved in the back half of refinancing and paying off the loans and working with lenders and everything over the past couple months. But the early parts of that loan, I don't have as much knowledge on. But so end of 2023, we finally secured funding to build the project. So now we're 15 months in, which again, I would do much sooner, but now we know, now we have a contact and, you know, we have a track record. So we submitted for permit basically like Christmas Day 2023, got the permit June 2024 and started construction immediately. And then construction went, you know, June, July 2024 to summer of 2025. I think we got our final certificate of occupancy like September 30th, 2025.
Any issues in the permitting process? You said it was about 6 months permitting process.
It was 6 months. I don't think, I'm trying to think what were some of the delays. Honestly, it was pretty straightforward. Nothing unusual. It was interesting. So typically I do residential work, right? Remodels, additions, dados, new houses, that sort of stuff. This was a 7,000 square foot, three-story, four-unit townhouse building. It was still under, pretty sure it was still under the IRC. So it was basically just designing a big house with firewalls and sprinklers.
Right. So four houses.
Yeah. So the actual, in the permit documents, the architecture was super easy. Very few corrections, really straightforward. All the stuff that was trickier or complicated or had a lot of hoops to get through was everything else. It was like civil and drainage and having to do a landscape plan, parking diagrams, just all the stuff that wasn't a house.
Did you work with engineers to do that or did you do that yourself?
We had a civil engineer, we had a structural engineer, and then I did the landscape plan and then we planted plants sort of based on the landscape plan and that was fine.
Just typically what developers do?
Yep. And then other things like the fire sprinklers was all design build along with the HVAC, so.
So how did construction go? You get your permit and how was construction?
Construction was fine. Like we're a small outfit. So Brent and his one employee, Edwin, built most of everything. We subcontracted out, you know, siding and like tile and like obviously like a lot of the trades, but the two of them oversaw and built so much. And I think, which is a huge cost savings because it was just two guys. In the future, I think next time, I think we'd encourage Brent to maybe like sub more stuff out or hire crews or just like hire another guy or two. Because I think we probably could have done some things faster if, you know, we just had more people on site. But trying to save every penny, and because Brent and Edwin did it, everything is just perfect. It's great to see the measurements of what gets built to just be so exact to what I drew. Or it's really funny, we'd be walking through the project late in construction and have, I don't know, like a prospective buyer or a real estate agent or a tile guy or some sub there, and they'd like ask what the dimension of something is. And I knew it because I designed the thing, and Brent knew it because he built it, and like we'd say the same number. My number is what came off the drawings, his is what he built, and it's just like...
Yeah, one of the beauties of doing development, right? You have a little more control over the quality of what you're building.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by WeCollabify, one of our trusted allied partners. As this community has grown over the years, one thing has become very clear to me. The partners we choose matter. Allied partners are not sponsors. They're not advertisers. They are organizations that we've taken the time to get to know, to work alongside, and to trust. They understand the real pressures of practice and the responsibility that comes with leading a small firm. WeCollabify earned that trust by helping small firm owners address a challenge that sits at the center of long-term firm health. Building capacity in a way that supports people, not just projects. Their insourcing model brings skilled design, BIM, and technical professionals directly into your team. They work in your time zone, inside your systems, and part of your day-to-day workflow. That integration allows firms to add capacity when it's needed, scale with intention, and grow without sacrificing culture, leadership focus, or quality of life. If you're thinking beyond short-term fixes and focused on building a firm that lasts, I encourage you, go learn why WeCollabify is one of our trusted allied partners. Visit WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect to learn more. That's WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, ARCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at ARCAT.com under the Resources tab. Or just go to ARCAT.com/Arcademy. That's ARCAT.com/ARCATEMY. That's ARCAT.com/Arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. Back to financing a little bit. So,
sure.
Did you get paid as an architect? Did you get architectural fees? And did Brent get contractor fees?
Not yet.
But that's the plan.
That's the plan. Okay. So, yeah. So what we did is any fees we pay to ourselves, I have documented and will pay ourselves at the end.
So that becomes part of your debt equation.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So the original plan was we were going to finish construction, sell 410 houses and cash out. And we would pay off our construction loan. We'd pay off debt to ourselves. We'd pay ourselves interest. We'd pay ourselves like architecture fee and a small developer fee and a contractor fee. Real estate agent would make a bunch of money.
Were those fees all pre-negotiated? Did everybody know what those were before?
Mostly.
Would you change that?
So yes, I would change that. Anyway, so all those numbers would come out, and then what's left would be the profit that we'd split three ways. So positive and negative here. Really enjoyed my two partners. We are as closer, friends today than we were at the start.
That's success alone right there.
It is. It is. So I never met Brent until we agreed to work together because he was Carrie's friend. But so he was a stranger on day one. But
yeah,
we get along really well. We're all still friends. So that's good. And so a lot of this was just like, oh, well, we'll figure it out or, you know, no problem. But if we had that business person who's like, no,
right,
we're not going to just no problem this. We need to have this documented because we want to be fair.
Yeah.
So my architecture fee was figured out. So there's a number that theoretically I'll get in the end. Brent's contractor fee is still a little like loosey-goosey that we need to resolve. So we know what it is, but there's wiggle room, which he's going to be fine with whatever. I want him to like maybe advocate for a little more for himself because we need to make sure he's whole at the end. And if you don't share every detail about how much you're owed, it's hard to make sure that we're doing right. So anyways, in the future, I would nail all that down, either a clear percentage of construction for the contractor or maybe just say, okay, per month, we're going to give you X number of dollars and we'll have that set at the end. So it'll all work out because I know we have, like I said, a really good relationship. And
right. But if you did it again, you would have a partner agreement that said architect's going to get this fee, contractor's going to get this fee, and everybody's on the same page. You agree up front before you do anything. And then at the end, you're just like, well, you pull out the contract. Here's the calculations, done.
Right. And a lot of this, skipping towards the end, a lot of this didn't seem like it was going to be that hard to resolve because we kind of knew where we're going to land for selling the units, and like we had a good idea of what we thought we were going to do. That didn't happen.
Yeah, I've been picking that up in our conversation.
So the idea was we were going to put the 10 houses for sale over the summer.
So when did you finish it and when did they go on sale?
So we got our certificate of occupancy like I think September 30th or October 1st, 2025. So they're ready to go on the market right around then. There was some last minute things with like cleaning up the site and like a whole other thing with condoization, which took a couple of months, but we were ready to go for sale October. We originally thought we were going to be ready in June, but everything dragged off. Your little guys, you just take longer. So we went on the market the same week as the government shutdown. If you all recall,
yes,
that we had like the longest government shutdown. It was basically like October, November, December, whatever.
Right.
So we were on the market during that and it was an awful time. We got, I think two people lowballed offered us to buy the whole property for a number that we would have lost tons of money.
Yeah. So was it the uncertainty of the government shutdown that caused the problem or?
I still don't know. I don't know if it was poor marketing. I'll talk about this in a second. We did the wrong product or interest rates. Or what?
Yeah, but interest rates probably impacted it a lot because interest rates are way up and everybody's thinking they're going to come back down. So everybody's on hold.
Yep. Interest rates did not help us. In Bothell, no townhouses were selling in the fall. So in the whole region of like the Seattle metro, townhouses are just a much harder sell than they were a year ago. So, you know, we started this project in 2022 and the market in Seattle has been basically gangbusters for like a decade. There's been little blips, but just like, it's not a question of like, how long will it take or how much money? It's just like, what offer are you going to pick after the first weekend, right?
Right. So you expected to just put them on the market and sell them by the end of the week.
Right, right. And that it sounds so cocky, but like really in Seattle for years, things sold. You know, and if they stayed on the market a little longer, then they just sold for less. But like, there's not a lot of inventory and things turn over. That changed completely fall of 2025. So we were on the market for about 3 months, just dead in the water. So we pulled them all off the market and we switched to rentals. Renting went extremely fast. It turns out the people who can't afford to buy townhouses can afford to rent and are excited to.
Yeah.
So we're now in the rental business and we're landlords, which was not what I was expecting. And in fact, at the beginning of this project, I was like, I don't want to be a landlord. I want to do the project which we could sell. And because of that, because I wasn't expecting to be landlords, all the projections that I had been running to figure out like how we could make money, how, you know, whatever, didn't incorporate being landlords at the end.
Right.
And now maybe there's someone who's listening to this podcast who's an experienced developer is like, well, Jared's an idiot. He should have known this stuff.
Well, a first-time developer, you don't know these things.
You don't know this stuff. And whatever you think you're prepared for, something else is going to show up. So I'm sure had we been prepared for being landlords, something else.
So that delays all your payments because that all came from a sale. So now you have tenants.
Yep.
So how does that work financially?
Poorly. So I've run all the numbers and whoever owns these townhouses in like 5 to 10 years is going to make a ton of money, is going to be so happy that they own these things. And the question now for the three of us is, can we afford to own them for that long?
To wait that long. Yeah.
And I don't know. It's going to have to be like another podcast episode. One that's like
cliffhanger.
The outcome of this. Yeah.
Because this just happened. You're talking about this past fall, October 20, so 6 months ago.
Yep. We have all of our tenants in and paying in as of like February. So we're still like getting up and running and have to like send bi-monthly water bills for the first time. Like it's now a full rental property, but we're still, you know, smoothing out all the kinks of what it means. And for the most part, it's running smoothly. There's, you know, one or two issues that, you know, could be, again, a topic for a sequel conversation. But
what about now that it's a rental, what about property management? How are you handling that?
That is the kind of same three-headed dragon that it has been previously. And so one of the partners, Carrie, lives like 4 blocks from the property. So he can come there anytime he needs. And he has landlord experience because of the building he lives in. So he's managed like meeting tenants and giving them tours and doing all the tenant onboarding stuff. When people have moved in and like the disposal hasn't worked or the oven is giving an error code or there's some like circuit breaker flipping, Brent, who doesn't live far away, shows up and does all that stuff. So he's like the on the ground facilities maintenance guy. And then I do everything else. And so this is where that business thing really came out, is like, my goal is to never meet any of our tenants, not because they're not wonderful people, but just because I don't need to. I can be the like disembodied voice in the background who reminds them that rent is due. And then everything that can be done offsite, I can take care of. So managing the books or paying bills, you know, paying taxes, whatever, that can be my role. So it separated out pretty nicely during this new phase that we weren't planning on having.
And what are you doing in terms of the income that it's producing? Are you just splitting that three ways or are you paying yourselves or how is that working?
I don't understand your question. Are we splitting three ways the money we have to put into the business to keep it solvent? Yes. So that's where we're at, is it's not making money right now.
Yeah.
It's like very close to breaking even, but it's not.
Well, you have interest on loans, right? That you have to
pay. Yeah. So we converted our construction loan into 4 individual mortgages. So each unit has its own mortgage. So theoretically, each unit has rent and a mortgage. And those more or less cancel out, but that doesn't include insurance. That doesn't include property taxes. That doesn't include—
So you're losing money by doing it this way.
We're losing money, but the way I rationalize it is the money we have to put in every month about equals the principal we're paying off. Assuming we're fortunate enough to have the money to put into the business, we're just taking money out of our personal account and it's going into building equity in the building. So theoretically, it's kind of a wash.
You're just moving it from one bucket to another. You just,
when you
get that bucket, you know, at the end, it'll all work out.
Yeah, it just means instead of the money that we have going into a retirement account or a Vanguard account or a vacation, it's going into this property, which is why I say that 5 to 10 years. If we can make it 5 to 10 years, the market will recover, the property values will go up, like we'll make money.
So is that the plan? I mean, the plan is a long-term rental until the market turns around and then you'll sell it.
Yeah, the plan constantly shifts. But right now we have, you know, 4 rented units. So when tenants leave, we'll look at the market and decide, okay, should we try and sell one?
Oh, right. Because now you have four. That gives you some flexibility.
Yeah.
Sell one and keep three.
Yeah. When a lease comes up for renewal, do we raise rent a little bit to make it better equalize what our debts are? So over the next, what I really think will happen is over the next like 1 to 3 years, we'll hopefully get debt in rent equalized either by refinancing because interest rates go down or by raising rent a little bit. And raising rent a little bit, not because we're greedy landlords, but because if we can raise rent by $200.
Yeah, it's a business decision. Yeah. Right now, the rent is established by market rate. That's what they'd be willing to pay.
It was established by, yeah, looking around at what the market rate was, putting it out there and seeing if we could rent it. And we did. So maybe we could rent it for a little more next time.
Yeah.
You know, and we hadn't fully refinanced, so we didn't know what number we had to have it at. Because everything with a small developer, it's easy to be out of order, right? You think you're doing the things in the right order, and then you discovered, oh, if I had known what my final mortgage payment was, if I knew what the interest rate was, if. So we could get closer to equalizing that. But what I think will happen is in the next couple of years, maybe one of our tenants will want to buy one, which would be great. Because if we can sell it off market without a real estate agent, that saves us tens of thousands of dollars. And that's potential profit right there. We'll maybe raise rent on some existing tenants or get new tenants that pay higher rent. Maybe we'll just sell one on the open market. Or, you know, if interest rates come down like 1% or 2%, refinance and get it down, which is like everything, this whole adventure is so like on the razor's edge, right? If interest rates go down, this project becomes viable quickly.
Right.
If we can sell one, we can cut the bleeding well, because not necessarily that, like if we could sell one tomorrow, as long as we can sell it for more than what our mortgages are, then we can pay ourselves a little bit and keep some money in the business and no longer have to put money into the business monthly. So maybe overall we would lose money because we wouldn't be as profitable, but we could extract money from the business and then have it kind of cost neutral for a year or two. So all these things will just like, you know, transform it, and who knows what's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah. A true testament to your partnership and your marriages.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, all of our partners have been great. And that's maybe the biggest tragedy of not selling all of these units like we wanted to is like, I was so excited to, it was like, you know what, even if we just break even and we make like $1,000, we'll take all of our wives out to dinner and the six of us will sit down and be like, well, that was an adventure.
Right.
And we'll have like really nice steaks or sushi or whatever.
Yeah.
That hasn't happened. So like that moment of getting to like turn to our partners and say like, thank you for being semi-willing participants in this crazy adventure.
Yeah.
We're not there yet.
Not yet. Not yet.
We'll get there. We'll get there for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Any regrets and any major lessons that you'd want to share with the audience?
Regrets is such a weird thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Would you do it again?
Yes. You see, there's a hesitancy right there.
Yeah.
So the regrets and the do it again. So would I do it again? Yes, but, right? I wouldn't do it again right now because I'm so deep into this current project.
Yeah.
And one of the lessons learned is like, for the past 3.5 years, I've been running two businesses. I have my architecture firm and I have this development company. And sure, the development company isn't a full-time job and it doesn't make full-time money, but like the mental load is it's a full business.
Yeah.
Right?
Probably worse,
so,
actually.
Yeah, yeah. So would I do it again? Yes, but not until this one is wrapped up and not until I have some like breathing room because this has been a long journey. Also, I would look at doing things slightly different from a financial standpoint because I'll be honest, we took a HELOC out in our house and so we borrowed money against our house to pay for this, which was fine. But it just meant there's that like mental burden of knowing that my wife and I have more debt because I'm chasing this crazy dream. So my wife has been fine about it and she's never like, she supports it, but like, I don't want to do that again. So I would do it again, but just with space. Regrets is a weird question because there's been some dark moments in this process and like some real lows, right? Like some real tough spots. But
What kind of, you don't have to get specifics if you don't want to, but like what type of lows? Is it like relationship woes or financial lows? Or
I think all financial. There's been no point where we've been worried about like, oh, we're not going to be able to afford to finish this, or I'm going to go into debt, or I'm going to lose my house or anything like that. But like when you're sitting on over $2 million of debt that you share three ways with two friends,
yeah, like stressful.
It's stressful, right? When you have over $2 million of debt plus the money that the business owes you and you can't give away a townhouse, it's stressful. So the financial stuff is just like, the dream of being a developer is to like make money.
Yeah.
But you just have to have this high risk tolerance of risking money. And like, that's gonna be the toughest thing to decide if I wanna try that again. But the regrets thing is interesting because this has been the best experience for me as an architect, as a business owner. I've learned so much and I am such a better like human being than I was 3.5 years ago. Just having to deal with so much of this stuff, whether it's just like taking ownership and being like, well, I guess I am going to be the person that picks up the phone and calls this vendor or makes this decision. Like there's no safety net, right? I could talk to my partners. I could say, hey, Carrie, what do you think about this? Or hey, Carrie, can you please do this thing? Because like, you'll be better at it, or I just need you to do it. But there's also just so much stuff where it's like, well, I can't say, okay, client, well, tell me what you want here and then I'll go do it. It's like, there is no client. We have to decide.
Yeah.
Or when we're trying to decide when to pull off the market and switch to rentals, there's no one there. I mean, my partners, right? We can talk about it, but Everyone's also laid back. And so someone has to be the guy who's like,
this is what we're going to do.
This is what we're doing. We're doing it. So there's been so much of that that has been such an incredible experience that if in 5 years, I just get my money back, like literally every penny I put in and I get out, no interest, no architecture fee. All I do is like that initial seed money plus all the money I've been putting in since then. If I just get that back up, it'll be worth it. Honestly, even if I lose every penny and we just sell the property for what the mortgages are worth and just walk away and go to sleep owning one house instead of one house plus what, 4/3 of a townhouse?
All the debt goes away. Yeah.
All the debt's worth it. Like it is, I describe it similar to like if you're fortunate enough to be an architect who designs a remodel to their own house or builds their own house. Like, it's stuff you're doing all the time, but just the experience of being the client and overseeing construction and all these things is such an amazing experience and so useful. And so now when I talk to my clients, like I've bought thousands of dollars worth of lights on Amazon. I've researched doorbells. I've compared house numbers and faucets. I've gone to Costco. I bought all the sinks at Costco. And I was not prepared for how big the boxes were. Cause I was like, oh, 12 sinks. This won't be bad. It was like, oh, it's so huge. I don't know how to describe it. I looked at him like, that's bigger than my car. I don't know how I'm going to leave Home Depot with all these sinks. Fortunately, Brent and Edwin were nearby. They both drove over. We loaded up my Mazda CX-5 in their pickup trucks with sinks and drove back to the site. It was fine. But it's like moments like that where you're standing in a Home Depot.
Yeah.
And you own a bunch of sinks and you're like, I made a huge mistake. That just makes me a better architect and it's going to allow me to serve my clients better. So that's it. So no regrets. Some shame. I wish I could have done things differently, but you know, that's just
lessons learned,
life.
Right? You just have some bruises from the experience.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So I'm hearing that if it all works out, maybe you do it again. But would you recommend others do it?
I think just reach out to someone who's done it before and talk to someone about it. For others to do it with partners. If I didn't have Carrie and I didn't have Brent there, no way I could have done this.
Yeah.
Even with the things where I, like the tasks that I did all the work for, having their support when I was doing those tasks was so important. So, and in the dark times, you have someone to commiserate with to be like, you know, why is this happening? Or I'm frustrated that we don't have this yet. Or can you believe that vendor did that or this? So having good partners to do it with makes it a worthwhile venture. But
formalize that partnership a little bit more.
Formalize that just to make your life easier.
Yeah.
and to protect everyone, and protect in the way of just like, you're looking out for each other, right? That's really what it is. You're not protecting each other from each other. Like, oh, you formalize it not because you're going to fight at the end, but like, I want the best for my partners.
Yeah.
And the best thing for my partners is for them not to have to—
Right, clarity.
Clarity, yeah, yeah. So would I suggest people do it? Yeah, because take risks, have adventures, but don't go in thinking it's a moneymaker. Don't go in thinking it's going to work the way you want. Don't go in thinking it's going to take the time you think it's going to take. Like, be prepared for the unknown roller coaster that is starting a business, right?
Yeah.
And starting a business that is, unlike an architecture firm that is all intellectual property, you just dig a giant debt hole and hope you get out at the end.
Yeah. Very, very different, very, very high risk.
Yeah. Another, I wouldn't say regret, but another like eye-opening life lesson is, so if you're going to do architect as a developer, you're doing something different. You're not just doing the architect thing. You're not just doing the developer thing. You're like, I think there's a better way. There's a more interesting way, or there's just a path I want to try and do to kind of fulfill my own curiosity or whatever. So we designed these cool townhouses, no garage, and living is on the third floor. In a market where your competition are basically giant houses squished next together, which have a two-car garage, a fireplace, the same exact living setup, a very formal primary bedroom rather than two bedrooms that are both en suite that could function as primary bedrooms or just roommate bedrooms. Market doesn't like that. So would I do something differently from a design standpoint? I don't know. But would I go in next time with a more clear view that when you do things that are atypical from the market, you need to be prepared to lower prices, justify it, market it harder, whatever.
Did you understand the market and intentionally do it differently, or did you just not understand the market well enough to?
I think a little misunderstanding the market, a little architectural arrogance, a little like don't care cavalierness, you know, a little of everything. I don't know that we would. So what I would do differently, one of the things that I was interested in doing was all four of our units are very, very similar. And this comes from my own architecture work. There's like an egalitarian nature to the way a plan lays out. If I have two kids' bedrooms, I want those kids' bedrooms to be equal, not necessarily identical, but I want each kid to go in and be like, I love my bedroom.
Right. Yeah.
It is different than my siblings, but it is like similar in size, similar in hanging space, whatever, the same number of windows. So there's this like thread throughout my work. And so I thought about the townhouses and like, I'm going to do the same thing. I don't want to like restrict someone to be like, the adult sleeps in this bedroom, or the person in unit A has a nicer unit than B. I want kind of everything to like spread everything out in a way that it makes them all very equal. And what I learned during the sale process is the real estate agents were like, okay, which is the worst unit? Let's put that on the market first.
They want
like
the differences.
You're like, you want me to say which of my kids I liked less? No, I love all my kids equally. I'm proud of them all equally, right? So I would be open to doing a variety of units. And so similarly, we have third floor living on all four units. If I were to do this again, I might put living on the ground floor of unit one and the second floor of unit two. Not because one is better than the other, but just to create diversity within the development and provide buyers with different answers.
Yeah, and flexibility in pricing as well. Because if there's differences, then you can justify that this is more expensive because it's different.
Right, right.
And if it's identical, they have to be the same price.
Yeah, and so there's subtle differences between all of the units. But really, I offered our buyers one experience with four slight variations. Next time, I would make them more different, and I think it could make for like a different-looking building too. So that's where my lessons learned are, is like, oh, if I could just scrap this building, start over, I know what I would design differently. But
yeah, well, hopefully there'll be a next one and you can come on again and give us an update on how this one resolved itself and how you started the next one and how you're applying those lessons to the next one. I'm sure it'll all work out in the end.
Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine how stressful it is because, you know, just running an architecture firm is stressful enough, but having millions of dollars of debt certainly compounds that. So I pray for you.
we also have millions of dollars of assets, right?
That's right. That's how you sleep.
Yeah. Once construction was done, we knew like we'd at least made it because we have a thing that's worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
So worst case is we just lose all the debt and we lose all the assets. That's not so bad.
Yeah.
That would be awful, but you know, it would be the end of the world.
Yeah. Well, any final lessons before I ask you my final question?
I think actually my final lesson is going to be the answer to your final question. So you could just ask me the final question.
Let's do that. So what's one thing a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Spreadsheets. This is my answer. It's the lamest, dumbest thing, but it's spreadsheets. So I have built a lot of extensive spreadsheets. I use Google Sheets, but you can do it with like whatever software you want to track income, to track our renters, to track all of the expenses during construction. I have all these crazy spreadsheets that look at, you know, if we sell the properties in 1 year, 2 years, down to 10 years for different prices, all this stuff, just really complicated spreadsheets. And those spreadsheets have kept me sane and have allowed me to forecast out through the end of the year to know what our finances are going to look like. I use them for construction scheduling, for so much stuff. And it's the backbone of this development process. I have probably spent as much time in spreadsheets as I did in ArchiCAD modeling and doing all of that stuff. So falling in love with spreadsheets and doing stuff. And to tie it into like 2026 trends, AI.
Yes.
Like the greatest thing in, I'm sure it's in all spreadsheet programs now, is to be able to be like, type into the, like the little AI bubble, give me a formula for X, Y, or Z. Right. And so my spreadsheets have gotten so much better because I don't have to understand the language of creating formulas. I could just be like, give me a formula that calculates this over this amount of time. Right. And there it is. So spreadsheets.
All right. Easy. I love it.
Low hanging fruit.
First time answer for that.
Really?
Yeah. First time.
It's a good one.
Yeah, it is a good one. His name is Jared Banks. He's the founder of Shoenome Architects and the co-founder of 10120. That's the development company. Everything can be found at shoenome.com. Take a look over there. You can also see his architecture. Are you doing consulting still for ArchiCAD?
Yeah, with the market slowing down.
If somebody pays you enough.
Yeah. I love helping other people. And so when someone's like, can you help me make my business better and talk about ArchiCAD? Yeah, I'm going to probably say yes to that.
Yeah, so. Nobody knows ArchiCAD better than Jared. So if you have a question, reach out to him, shoenome.com. Jared, thank you. I appreciate you for keep coming back and sharing valuable knowledge with our community. You have taken so many risks and come here and openly share them with our community. It's very, very valuable to anyone who is considering doing something like what you're doing. And so thank you. Thank you for sharing your story and for coming by here and hanging out with me at Entree Architect Podcast.
My pleasure. It's always such a great time chatting with you, and I just appreciate the opportunity to share.
If you enjoyed this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link with a friend, because that's how we've continued to grow and serve thousands more small firm architects just like you. Thank you to our sponsors for this episode. Links to the sponsors and all the resources we discussed today, they are all available in the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a proud member of the Gable Media Network. It's the multimedia network moving the architecture, engineering, and construction industries forward through the power of storytelling. You can earn AIA continuing education credits by listening to select episodes of this podcast and many others at gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, listen up. Join us today at Entree Architect Network. It's the worldwide community for entrepreneur architects. We've been around since 2012, and our basic level is now free to join. Yes, you can join Entree Architect Network for free. And that gives you access to valuable business resources and our global community of architects. And you can upgrade anytime for live coaching, AIA approved training, and mastermind support. So visit entrearchitect.com to learn more and to get started. My name is Mark R. LePage. Thank you for listening to the Entree Architect Podcast. Love, learn, share. Are you NCARB certified yet? Join the network of over 45,000 architects who have the NCARB certificate to expand your professional reach. By becoming NCARB certified, you are demonstrating that you've met the national standards for licensure, a qualification that can be an important factor for firms when hiring and promoting. Certificate holders have a streamlined path to apply for a reciprocal license in all 55 U.S. jurisdictions, as well as access to an extensive library of free continuing education courses. Learn more today at ncarb.org.